Sorry, trying to be all crazy. We'll jump right into it, and as usual, folks may come. So, I think I can take the liberty of saying so. Alan Shapiro tried to do the homework, which was, they had this idea that the Sefirot, in particular, chesed, loving kindness, its mirror, gevurah, and then the balance of the three, tiferet, which is really balance, or a kind of inner radiance or beauty. The three of those are represented by three different colors. That those colors are white, red, and green. It isn't lost on me that in the ancient world there were, humors. People may be familiar with the humors of the ancient world, these essential archetypes, and white, red, and green represent three of the four humors of the ancient world. I don't know if the Zohar is relating to that or not. But the idea that spiritual energy is tied to light and color certainly makes sense, both from an experiential perspective and even now. I was thinking about Einstein for whatever reason in preparing this class, and his fundamental notion, yes, that energy is matter times the speed of light squared. And in other words, energy, even the very basic thing we talk about in our universe, is defined by the relationship between matter, between things, and light. So it is not but crazy to be talking about the energy of the universe, even in a scientific way, in the context of light, and here in particular, light and its colors. So we have an association here of three angels, Michael, who is Chesed, Gabriel. Oh, everyone's coming in. Okay. I've trained everyone to be late. Okay. This is me. So, Rabbi Confer, I'll get out of this equation in a minute, but just so you know, today we're going to do the Zohar on the secret meaning of the name Kuzu B'muchzaz Kuzu, which you may have seen. So, if we get, we
One
do
of
it fine.
Rabbi Lehman's favorite codes.
Yeah. So, at the end of today, you'll actually know what it all means. You once asked, what does it mean? Today, we're going to get there. So we have Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael, these three angels, which represent Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet. But another way of talking about that is in terms of colors of light, of white, Chesed, loving kindness, red, Gevurah. And these are, of course, associations deep in human culture. Red is, of course, related to blood. It's hard to imagine not. And green, Tiferet, or balance. I will note, of course, that color has a big interplay, or a large interplay, with human consciousness and creativity, right? And so just changing the color of the background, as they've done in many experiments that people are looking at, dramatically changes their entire body and the kind of feedback. Blue and green palettes, for example, are what promote restfulness, creativity, and thinking. White, sort of alertness. Red will put people in a kind of fear state. And these are not culturally associated. They don't think they've studied them across cultures, even. There's a Time magazine issue on this. These are not culturally associated things. These are just how humans interact with color. So color is real. So is the appearance of the surrounding radiance. So we have this idea that there is a radiance surrounding God, but the radiance surrounding God is concealed in the revolving, in revolving the vision of the eye, right? So I know some people tried this and couldn't do it, but the basic idea here is that we actually, it's our perception creates the radiance of God. There's an interplay. It's not that God shines light and if we're good enough, we can see it. The very fact that we see is kind of like our radio antenna in the Zohar's imagination for sensing divinity. It works both ways. God created light energy because we can see, or we can see that. That's the that's the way the system has evolved. The spiritual system has evolved. But the Tsar is making a very strong point here. We can see angels. We can see divinity, right? It's saying something very, very radical. Okay. I'm going to read, and then we'll. The appearance of the image of the presence of Yud He Vav He colors, for the lower unity is unified in accord with the unity above. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem, right? So in the Shema, we have Shema Israel, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. So we're gonna, we got a little bit of this in the Hakdamah, in the introduction. We're gonna get a little more of it now about the mystical understanding of the Shema, of the recitation of Shema. So there are many ways to understand three divine names in that. But the way the Zohar is understanding that is Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hashem. First Hashem is Chesed. God's first and foremost instinct is loving kindness, to be kind to us. This is seen by the liturgical blessing that was placed right before the blessing of Ahavah Rabbah Tanu or Ahavat Olam, right? An eternal love God has shown us, great kindness. So loving kindness is the first manifestation of God's name. Elokeinu, our God, the one we actually experience, the one with the name Elohim here, is Gevurah, is God who judges us, punishes us even, holds us to account, or worse. Hashem, Chesed, Elokeinu, Gevurah, Hashem, that is now the same name as before, but it has emanated, Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet. And so here we are, by using the same name, noting a theory of emanation, that everything is one and nothing has changed, really. It's all just clothed in a different way or a different part of its own development. But we're up to a different point, and that is Tiferet. So here the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh means Chesed in the first time, and Tiferet the second time, and then Echad, one, is a way of kind of noting yesod. Colors concealed, unrevealed, banding together to one place, one unity above. So all of these colors, the white, red, and green of Hashem, white, Elokeinu, red, Hashem, green. And the Zohar is here instructing a practice, just to be clear. It is imagining that when people recite the Shema, they're going to picture the first name, Yod He Vav He, in white letters in their mind's eye. And then when they picture the second name, Elokeinu, they're going to picture the word Elokeinu in red letters in their mind's eye. And then when they picture the third name of Hashem, Yod K Vav K, they're going to picture it in like green, or sometimes their green looks like blue. And so they're really imagining a kind of meditation on the names of God using colors in order to, as a medium for, coming into attunement with the energy of the Sefirot. And then Echad, right? Colors concealed. So this is all of the divine energy is not yet revealed. Nope. Sorry. It's not yet revealed. It's not in the earth. It's not in Shekhinah. It's white light. It's not a manifest in a rainbow in different colors. Unrevealed. Banding together to one place is Yesod, a place where all the divine colored consciousness come together. One unity, it's all one, but it's above. Above meaning not in our world, it's above our world. It's in Yesod. So the first set, a verse in the Shema, it is called by later by the Hasidim, and Chabad picks up on this the most. The Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, called this the Yichud Ilah, the upper unity. It's about taking the colors, taking the light energy, taking the various manifestations that are beyond our world, and imagining that all of those energies, which start as one and then differentiate, recongeal, as it were, or reunite into one energy. A more, less cryptic way of saying it is A lot of times our world feels like chaos and feels like the manifestation of lots of different sorts of energy. You know, there's you and me at a basic level. There are people in relationships with their conflict, or there are countries at war with each other. Like, there are real differences between how people view the world and real separation. So that is all a manifestation of we could imagine lots of energy above. You know, not that this is all the product somehow of one God or one thing, but a total chaos or multiplicity or good and evil in the Zoroastrian sense, a good God and an evil God and a constant war or struggle. The Zohar almost goes that way sometimes. So, but no, the Shema is a declaration of faith that all of the divine energy that will ultimately manifest in this world, that's collected above, is one. It's a unity. There is no difference. And we are therefore parts of a unified whole and together. We're interdependent, believe it or not, which is true. Happens to be. We are all interdependent. So that's the first sentence of the Shema, the Yichud Ila'a, the upper unification. And as we learned in the introduction, the Zohar has its variation of the practice. It wants us to take the word echad and to stretch out that word, not just for a long time, but as long as it takes to say each of the prior words. So if you're saying the Shema like a Zoharic mystic, you're seeing the letters of God's name in colors, and those represent the Sfirot. And when you get to the word Echad, which represents Yesod or the gathering of the unity of the energy, it is the very chanting of that name which causes the upper energy to unify. It's not reflective, it's theurgic. It causes unity above and gathers it, getting it ready to enter our world. So the Shema is actually a preparation for what comes after, which is drawing down unified divine energy into the world. And how do we do that? We do that in the Zohar's mind after having the right intention when reciting the names, in particular of God, by prolonging Echad, which people hear people do. You know, it's a popular thing to do. There is a version of it in the Talmud that is not mystical explicitly. But the Zohar's version of it has that echad being as long as it takes to say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem, because you're unifying all that energy. So you need to create enough sound space for the reverberation of all of the energy from the sounds of reciting Shema to enter into the container of Yesod or Echad. So by seeing the colors of the divine names and creating the sound container of unity that allows the divine energy to come together in one place, the Zohar is creating a practice that uses light and sound. You know, there's no electromagnetism yet. I don't know if there's not a magnetic version of this, but working with different energy forces, right, to create unity, right? So the Zohar is trying in our own recitation, in the way we see and perceive, in the way we hear, to al allow for us to create the conditions for Shema to be true. Because if we don't, maybe it's not, you know, because there can be disunity in the heavens. That's the other piece. We've seen that in some of the stories and the mythologies about the fighting between the Sefirot. I'm going to pause there before we get to the lower unity in a moment, but questions or comments? I've said a lot.
I had a quick question about whenever we get to these sorts of things where there's a practical ritual act that we do, so the elongating of the Echad, I'm always wondering is like, was that like a practice that existed before the Zohar? That this is kind of, I guess before is like the wrong word, but I guess that does the popularity of that or the practice of that today, does that come from Zohar practices or is that an existing practice like that goes back to, I don't know, a time before maybe the Zohar was quite as well known?
That's a really good question. So the practice is cited in the Talmud, and so it's certainly older than the written text of the Zohar. That being said, lots of practices are cited in the Talmud. I simply don't know. Did that practice become popular because people were doing daf yomi since the 1800s, and they came and it's in Brachot, the first Masechta in the first chapter of the first, and lots of people saw it in the Talmud because the Talmud has become ever more popular as the years go on. And so people saw it in the Talmud and started doing it. Or did it become popular because the Arizal and the Hasidim following the Zohar emphasized that this is very important? Or some, like, what was the thing that caused this practice to become? So I don't know. I've observed over my years that actually lots of people now in synagogues of different denominations and different stripes of different sorts are prolonging Echad. Not the masses, but there's always someone sitting there as the Shema is going, you hear the Echad going on and on. And is it because they've studied the Zohar? Is it because they were a Chabad got to them? Is it they read the writings of Luria? Or is it the Talmud? I don't know. I don't know.
So I have a physics motivated question. I'm interested in breaking up light into the three colors of white, red, and green, not so much because they don't have exactly the same list of spectral colors as we do, but normally white is associated with the totality of the light. And here it's being used as a primary color that's part of light. Am I reading it correctly? And is there some other color that represents the totality of light, or is it just a not very well thought through primary color system by my lights?
No, so I think what is happening, I was thinking about this myself. I believe what is occurring is they imagine that chesed, or the white light, isn't just one in a list, but rather it is, like you say, kind of an inclusive color. And so they imagine that everything else is in some way a manifestation of chesed, because chesed is the first of the lower seven sphere. And so everything else emanates from chesed. Mm. So they imagine that white light is the starting point and the end point. And we start with white light and we end with white light, and we're kind of refracting it in the middle. That's what I think. I wouldn't swear that that's the right interpretation. It could be, like you said, a not super precise color thing. But I'm pretty sure that's what they mean. And by using white for chesed, they actually mean to teach us that even gevura is a manifestation of chesed. This matches, the evidence I have for this is that the Zohar advises in another place that when praying, one should place their left hand in their right hand. I think we may have even seen this passage. And so that would look like this. And they imagine that because the right hand symbolizes chesed and the left gevura. And so the Zohar imagines that gevura is held within chesed, you know, not that it's an internal feature to it. And then I would say, just, we all know, actually, that the deepest manifestations of love we can have for people sometimes, or we can only have more critical, loving relationships with people who we're actually very close to. Right, like, you can't go to a mild acquaintance and offer them critical life advice that, like, but if you know, have a spouse, you know, maybe it's not always so gentle, but like, you, those are people actually who, like, people will usually listen to critical advice from their spouse, for example. So gevura as a manifestation of love is a Kabbalistic. That's why I think that.
Thank you.
Now, I'll read a little more. The colors of the rainbow below, uniting white, red, and green, match the concealed colors, composing another unity, mystery of Ushmo Echad, his name is one. Blessed be the name of his glorious kingdom forever and ever, the unity below. The unity above is, Hear, O Israel, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. Yod Heh Vav Keh is our God. Yod Heh Vav Keh is one. One parallels the other. Six words, Hear. Six words there. So when we recite Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed, blessed is the name of his, well, Shem Kavod, of the glory of his kingdom forever and ever, which is a response to hearing the name, right? Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed is a response. It's a liturgical response to hearing the divine name. The Zohar, that's the plain exoteric meaning of Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed, used in the temple when the divine name is uttered. It's like we have the shorthand in synagogue, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo, blessed is he and blessed is his name. So Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed is the long version of that. So for the Kabbalist, the Shema represents a string of divine names, the first, and a fundamental description. Now, I just want to highlight how radical this is. For a Maimonidean, the Shema is like a creed declaration of the absolute monotheistic unity of God. That God is undifferent, and Rambam is explicit, that God has internal and external unity, using the language of the Greek philosophers. External unity, that there is one God and not two gods, which is probably the plain meaning of the Shema. And internal unity, that there is no division or separation within the Godhead. In Maimonides' way of thinking about it, the God does not change, the God does not have parts. For the Kabbalists, the Shema is a coded description of the parts of God in God's emanations in the divine realm. And so it means a totally different thing to the Zohar than it would have meant. Say, it actually means the almost... It's like almost opposite, not opposite, but so we've got all the energy from reciting Shema gathered together and unified with our great intention in Yesod. But then it has to somehow, we have to, if divine energy is unified above by our practice, the urgic practice being practice that influences a God or the realities or the heavens, then how do we cause unified divine energy above to come down on earth? Right? Oseh shalom bimramav, who makes peace above, who yaseh shalom aleinu. How do we bring it down to us? So that is the intention of the recitation of the next verse, Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed. Now, there is an exoteric meaning plain meaning, take of this, right? What's the plain meaning? What in the tradition, what's the plain reason why we recite Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Leolam Va'ed after the Shema? There's like a fundamental reason, which I think I've mentioned, right? The fundamental reason is whenever we hear the name, we recite this, and this is the long form formula. But then there's also a story that is associated with this in the Midrashic tradition.
Isn't it Moshe heard this from the angels when he went to heaven?
Oh, there is that, though that's not the reason cited in the sources, but that is another Midrashic tradition. Mm-hmm. Right, the one in the tradition is that when Jacob was going to reveal the end of days to his children, there was a block in his he had Ruach HaKodesh, he had some kind of inspired spirit, but suddenly the spirit left him. And so he thought to himself, maybe there is something in one of the children, my children, present in front of me, that is causing a block in the spiritual energy. After all, Avraham had Yishmael, and etc. You know, all my fathers had, you know, Yitzchak had Esau, and you know, all of them had someone. And so maybe the reason the spiritual energy departed is because one of the people here isn't worthy. And so they've caused a blocking of the flow of energy. That's what the Midrash says. And then they assure him by saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Their response is, listen, Israel, because he's actually named Israel. No, we all believe that God is one. And they proclaim this faith. And Baruch Shenkvo Malchuto L'Olam, that is the response. So in inserting Baruch Shenkvo Malchuto L'Olam Ba'ed, we are echoing the call and response of Jacob and his children. That's the plain story that's told. The Zohar is taking with this on another level. The energy is unified above, but something is blocking the flow from entering the world, right? So it's the same Jacob problem that he has, which is he had an inspired, or it's the same problem many of us have. We have moments of inspiration in our lives, but those moments are excessively fleeting and hard to hold on to, yeah? And they're quick to go. It's easy for the happenings of the world, right? So the Zohar is dealing now with a universal human spiritual problem. Our moments of inspiration are locked up. They're just beyond what's accessible. We tasted them and they're gone. That's the problem they're dealing with. And so even if we're able to acknowledge or even create by our acknowledgement divine unification above, how do we access that in our world when it's all there? That's what the Zohar is getting at here. And so they say that Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Li'olam Ve'ed, blessed is the name of his glorious kingdom forever and ever. Well, look, that has six words. And the one above has six words. So the six words represent Tiferet, represent kind of the balance of divine energy with all of the spokes of the wheel, Chesed, Gevurah, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. They represent all of that. So by reciting six words which acknowledge God's kingdom, that is this world, we are creating, again, new sound energy for the unified energy above to enter into the world. We're creating an equal number of containers to the number of spherot that we want to be in the world. And we're creating an equal number of words for the words in the first sentence of the Shema to enter into the second sentence of the Shema, as it were. We're drawing the energy down by creating space for that energy to occur in the recitation, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Li'olam Ve'ed. And so there must be six words corresponding to the six sfirot, which are gathered in Yesod above, and then entering into Shechina, entering into the manifest world. So that's how they understand the Shema. The Shema is a chanting audio, it's an audio-visual way of gathering divine energy and then allowing that divine energy in the second paragraph to become present in us and therefore manifest in the world. Okay, so now I'll pause there. That's the Zohar on the mystical intention of reciting the Shema. Comments or questions there, and then...
Can I just ask, is the same logic for Yehi Shmei Rabbah in the... Because that's basically the translation of Baruch Shem Kvod. So is it the same idea there, or?
Yeah. Now there is a mystical teaching about from the Merkava school about the number of letters and words in that phrase. It's complex, so I won't do it now. But if you want, at some time we can take a detour and do that. That comes yet from the Hechalut Rabati, which we haven't ventured too much into here, you know, very cryptic mystical texts. If this seems cryptic, those are really cryptic because they're actual gibberish. But there they get into some numerology with that. But yes, and they have a similar alternative numerological system with the Yehi Shmei Rabbah where it becomes the manifestation of divine energy. So this was a mystical Jewish thing, you know, going back, I would say. Other comments or questions, and then I'll read the next thing, and then we'll decipher.
Just to reemphasize what you said about the fancy word theurgy, and this is such a different world. When we talk about prayer or teach it to our congregants, we talk about gratitude, you know, even request, praise of God. This is not that world at all. This is the world of saying the words are a meditative way of actually bringing divine energy down and bringing and enhancing the harmony and of the universe, of the cosmos. And that's such a radical, different way of seeing Jewish practice. You know, it's not about, I mean, I know you're trying to make it interpersonal, but they're not talking about being nice to your wife. They're talking about bringing this kind of cosmic unity. So it's interesting in how we relate to that. I'm just thinking about that again.
There is a deeply, so it's both deeply universal in that sense of bringing cosmic unity, and then this practice. So I appreciate you highlighting just how different this is than the way we often think about this. It's even more than that, because the Zohar is basically making a claim, an implicit claim, that actually our states of consciousness are what affect, first of all, affect the divine realm. Our actual states of consciousness cause changes within God. And our states of consciousness are what manifest harmony and divine energy, or God forbid, discord and hellishness, as we've seen, you know. And there is, I guess I want to say something about that here. I think there's a great truth to be had that we've all been lost in Jewish traditions, where we've had a very heady version of the religion that is very focused. And it's a good thing. It's not bad, but on like the ethics of it or the intellectual like analysis of a particular thing, often to the ignorance of our own self-awareness about how we're actually, like, there are lots of Jewish teachers that teach things, but then are like wholly unaware, not just like are aware, but we're all human, are wholly unaware of, you know, sometimes great hypocrisy or other manifestations of that. I think because there's a lack of spiritual self-examination. The Hasidim were trying to balance that, the Kabbalists too, in the Jewish tradition. The Zohar is taking out a claim, actually, that first and foremost, it isn't necessarily our intellect, but it's actually our state of consciousness or being that is going to permeate certain energy. And that will be a foundation for ethical action and mitzvah observance. Or that the mitzvah observance, when understood properly, actually leads to that, but it cannot ignore a foundational aspect, which is about consciousness, and that there are certain practices in a world of disharmony, which can cause kind of collecting ourselves. Some of the Kabbalists imagined that the Shema was a practice for what they called Pizor HaNefesh, the spreading out of the soul. You know, sometimes our soul is discombobulated, they imagined, or our lives are discombobulated. And the Shema is a way of gathering divine energy and prioritizing and drawing it down. I think the Shema does serve as a kind of prioritization for people, right? Of like, oh, right, like I do a lot of things in life and I'm going to be Jewish, right? The Shema does have that kind of fundamental, like, part. So I don't know if my point has been clear, but the main point is, the Zohar is making a claim that first and foremost states of consciousness affect our action. And if we focus on the spiritual practices that will affect our state of consciousness, that's the way to change the world, actually. So that's an interesting, that'll have ripples.
So your state of consciousness during prayer is...
Your state of consciousness during prayer is actually going to change the world. So that's... It's not just going to change your own self, your day, your self-perception. It's actually actively changing the cosmic state of the world through you.
And I guess a version of the question, because I'm not sure I heard Rabbi Confer and Rabbi Dollinger saying things that sounded the same, but if I may, in Rabbi Confer's question, there was implicit the idea that the divine level is pretty separate. And in Rabbi Dollinger's answer, I heard that unifying divine energy is really manifest in the human world. So there seems to be a tension between ways of thinking about this whole system. Is that a fair observation?
Because the Zohar isn't an emanated system. And so if everything is an emanation of God as a way of saying how things come to be, and then we are emanations of God, in which case we are divine beings of light, literally here. And I sound like a yoga teacher now, you know, like the light in me is bowing down to the light in you, right? And Tzvi Ish Bar Shalom has done the research on the overlap between the Zohar and Hinduism, if you're interested. You know, he does think there was more contact than is imagined. But yeah, there's a way in which, right, our limbs are manifest in the spherot, and sometimes they're referred to as divine limbs. And so the humans are like little demigods, you know, and we are manifestations of the representation of a whole concealed, as they call it, a hidden world of divinity that's in us. It's not beyond us. The Zohar imagines that you actually delve into yourself in order to access the divinity, because we're all manifestations of that. Or deep meditation and being with the self is actually like a portal to what is beyond. So yeah, there's a fundamental difference between relating to God as other versus relating to God as immanent, present within. Now, the Zohar is doing both here. It's relating to God as beyond or transcendent in the first part and imminent in the second part. So they're trying to square that a little bit. You know, God who is beyond us. But of course, we affect God who is beyond us by our very action because God is within us. So they're dealing with this paradox in a very interesting way. You know, is God in us or are we not God? Because there are great problems, of course, with people that think they're God, you know. Ethical problems, personality problems, all kinds of problems.
In the sixth spirit, here and there, above and below, Chesed and Gevurah are double counted. Am I getting that right?
So let me show you. Hold on.
I'll go
to the visual. Is that okay? We'll go to the chart. Hold on. So there are actually different ways in the commentaries of how to count this. So Avi hits on a point, but let's try some ways of understanding it. The first six words of Shema represent 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this kind of these six of the lower seven spherot, and the six words of Baruch Shem Kvod Malchut Olam Ve'ed represent the same, but are drawing it into Shechina or Olam Ve'ed, into time. But like literally, it says, "Blessed is God forever." So once we're drawing it into time, we're drawing it into space, right? We're drawing it into space-time, you know? So they imagine the six are kind of the same, if that makes sense. Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And this Tiferet represents Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey, ultimately, represents the anchor or the balance of all the divine energies. This is another point I haven't really focused on, but that the words in Shema represent a balance, right? We talked about different colors, but Chesed and Gevurah are opposites. Netzach and Hod Yod are seen as opposites. And so this is also a version of spirituality in which the point of religion is to bring the world into balance. It's not often a way, to Rabbi Conference point, we speak about like what the Jewish, I don't know, when I went to Hebrew school, Temple Beth El of North Belmore, no one ever said, recite the Shema and practice it so you learn to bring the world into cosmic balance. I don't know, one time Shlomo Carlbach visited, maybe he said something like that. I don't mean to trigger people with his name, but you know what I'm saying? But like other than like the one rare hippie occurrence, it was, you know, that's not what it was. Memorize the Shema as a requirement of graduation, and here's the sticker on your chart. But also, and we did, thank Mrs. Cantor, Ruth Cantor, who made us memorize every word of the Shema. But you know, it's that wasn't it. It was about obey God, you know, listen to God. Or Jews died saying this, and you will die saying this if you need to, should the time come. Those were the messages that were imparted, kind of. So, but not about, you know, that they represent a kind of harmony of disparate energies. Does that answer your question, Avi, sort of?
Well, there's seven, and once you add Malchut at the bottom, so what does one of them not get counted there? How does...
Yeah, so that's a good question. So
I don't mean to be so literal, I just...
No, so I think they imagine when we say Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Li'olam Ve'ed that we're actually not not counting Malchut as one of the seven, but rather kind of it's the six energies above, which we're drawing into Malchut with the denote.
Oh, it's the like meaning. From above, then going below.
Going below. And it's actually the meaning of the words Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Li'olam Ve'ed, which is the seventh. So there are six words, but the seventh is created by the meaning of the words itself. Peter Salson.
Yeah, so just to make sure I understand this exchange between the two of you, Rabbi and Avi. So in a way, at least on this page of the Zohar, Malchut is living below a line that divides the upper world from our world. So even though Shekhinah is the presence of Hashem, it's the presence of Hashem in our world. Is that a way to understand the...
Yeah, the Kabbalists understood that the Shekhinah is the manifestation of divinity within the physical world. Within the physical world. It is God within. And that is why they sometimes refer to the Shekhinah as poor or impoverished, which is their favorite description of the Shekhinah. Because the Shekhinah is always in need of receiving energy, but has no inherent identity of her own, other than as a receptive vehicle. Now, they imagined this as an archetype of a woman. There's a lot to say about that, you know, that women only receive things from men. But they also imagined it as the archetype of a woman giving birth, giving birth to reality, right, to life. And so, yeah, Shekhinah only receives is why they often refer to Shekhinah as poor. And Dal, represented by Dal, it often represents, like the Dalet and the Chad can be seen as pointing to Shekhinah. And there is a kind of line, right? Even though we tend to think of Shekhinah as this great divinity kind of figure. This, by the way, is the Kala, you know, the Shabbat Kala is this too. But really they have in mind something more like the divine within. Ikavu, let the waters be gathered, surveying. So remember, this all started because we were Yikavu Hamayim Mitachat Hashemayim. So actually, just to be clear, there are upper waters and lower waters. And where are those waters divided? They're divided in between Yesod and Shekhinah, right? On the second day. But Yikavu is a line connecting them. Even though the text is dividing them, we're uniting them, which is just a picture of the Zohar doing. Text is talking about the division of the upper waters and lower waters. But immediately, the Zohar says, well, if they're divided, if there's a division between divine energy above and below, let's bring it in. Let's unify. So it's an invitation to practice. Division, in other words, is an invitation to practice. The Shema was created on this day, the need for it. Measure plumb of dark brilliance, as is written, who measured the waters with the hollow of his hand? This is Yikavu Hamayim, let the waters be aligned. Here is the measure of the creator of the worlds. Yud He Vav He, holy, holy, holy. Yud He Vav He of hosts. Holy, 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 let the waters be aligned. Yud He Vav He of hosts. To one place. In the mystery of this name, The whole earth is full of his presence. Let the dry land appear. Engraved mystery, name of unity. Kuzu b'muchzaz kuzu. So here we have the Zohar's first introduction of Rabbi Confer's favorite cryptic cipher name. And it's in a passage that's actually fairly cryptic itself. I don't know if we'll be able to finish the whole passage today, but we'll take a first crack at it and probably return to it next time. So you can probably sense from this that in this text, in this passage, whoever's writing it has worked him or herself up, I suppose is always a possibility, although I doubt it, into some kind of ecstatic state. This is an ecstatic, Malila has encouraged us, those who have, of us who have learned, to see when the Zohar, the person writing the Zohar, seems to be writing in some altered state of mind. Sometimes they're writing in like a creative writing state of mind, and sometimes it seems to be an altered state of mind. This seems to be an altered state of mind because it is replete with divine names and exclamatory quotes when prophets see God. So whenever they're using exclamatory quotes for when visions of God are attained by prophets, you can imagine that the writers of the Zohar imagined a prophetic vision of God. Let's just be clear. That's also crazy, radical, whatever word you want to use. We're taught that nevuah or prophecy ended, you know, a long time ago, and people don't run around as prophets. But here are authors of the Zohar using the words of the prophets to describe the things they're seeing in real time. Like God. Okay. So, line and measure. Measure plum of dark brilliance. So this is a theme we've had before, that the light is actually brilliantly dark. We've even had full terminology and statements for that in prior things. I'm just going to go to the mat note for a second, if that is okay. Yes. So he quotes that, what we've seen before, the Butzina de Cardinuta. There was a textual question about whether that's what it said there, if you may recall. But lamp of impenetrability, or a spark of impenetrable darkness. I don't know what more I want to say about that, other than understanding that there's this concealed light adds a little bit of texture to the idea of brilliant darkness. There's a brilliance to the universe that we do not see, right? So that's what we mean by brilliant darkness, actually, right? There's something sparkling and spectacular that isn't manifest physically. We can think of it in terms of light, but we actually can't see it. So it is a dark brilliance, or a butzina de cardinuta. It is the momentary inspiration you may have to know that the world is got to have more to it than you can perceive. That there's a deep world beyond that of human thought or even human awareness or perception. So one can have an awareness, an awe, that there's something far beyond human perception. And that awareness is full of light, but the light is entirely unseen because it's beyond human perception. And so it's plum of dark brilliance. As is written, who measured the waters with the hollow of his hand? This is an ode to divine transcendence, that God is beyond anything we can imagine. Only God, they could have quoted from Job here too, only God can understand all the mysteries. So even as we're being audacious here, there's a limit. And the Zohar has to keep reemphasizing that because it's doing really bold things. You're going to do bold things. You have to remember or remind yourself that, like, there's some limit or God beyond. Otherwise, you could get all kinds of spiritually dangerous or just bad things. This is Yikavu Hamayim, right? Yikavu from Kav, line, gather the waters, means let the waters be aligned, like literally in a line. Let them flow line to line. Here is the measure of the creator of the worlds. I do want to say something about this. There is ascends in the mystical tradition that God has measurements. There was a particular text called Shir Kuma, the measurement of the height, which is a early mystical work, which literally sought to describe God's measurements like a tailor would. It was highly controversial. You know, God's this is this many that kinds of things, for reasons you may imagine. Peter Salzman, are you trying to say something?
Go on, I'll ask a question after you're done with this thought.
But here, what they're imagining is the fact that there are lines, right? So lines, they mean something more like line segments, can be measured, as it were. So even though God is beyond, but actually, when God did measure the water. So here we're saying something very profound. There is a God beyond any description, even beyond the spherot, and that is the sphere of Keter. But God chose to manifest God's self through a series of emanations, and those series of emanations are measured, meaning they are designed ultimately to relate to our consciousness. This goes back to Rabbi Confer's point before. All of this divine energy is ultimately designed to be perceived by us, or to be not perceived by us, but to be perceived in its lack of being perceived by us. It's designed to be correspondent to the human spiritual perception, or not just human, but created spiritual perception of the entire created world. And so God did measure, who here can be seen as an allusion to Bina, if you want to. Some commentaries see that who, you know, is a kind of sphera that is the gatekeeper for what can and can't be understood or measured. And the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh with olives, and I'll get into this before, is often seen as the name corresponding to Tiferet and the six spherot around. That's sometimes because Hey, the second Hey, is the numerology of six. If you don't have to spell it with an aleph, you could spell it with Hey with a 10. You could spell it Hey Yud. So when you spell Hey Aleph twice, it represents Tiferet and its spokes. That's how the Kabbalists understand it. This is the name of 45. And so they're doing that here because it is the measurement of all of the major spherot. That's this name. So they're saying that this name is associated with God and these spherot. And when you see this name, and they literally spell it out in the text of the Zohar like this, holy, 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 Lord of hosts, right? So there's this great holiness to being able to behold, you know, the measurements of the divine. And if you can really see it, so there's like an ecstatic state that's created here. God of hosts. God, Tiferet, is creating spokes of a wheel. That's what they mean by Hashem Tzvakot. This is from the Kedusha, right? Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakot, Meloch Hola Aretz Kavodo. So they're now in interplacing this teaching into that line from the Kedusha, that Kadosh, 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 I'm not going to have enough time for what I want to say, but Kadosh, 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 removed. Kadosh means separate, holy, totally different. Holy is not mundane. God is totally beyond us. But Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh of hosts, Tiferet, hosts the measure of the divine, which even though it is totally removed from us, we can sense and perceive. And in stating that, we cause it to be. So in declaring three times how removed or different God is, we are able to actually sense, perceive, create a vision of God. Holy, 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 let the waters be aligned. When we recite this, in other words, says the Zohar, and when we recite it, the name we should have in mind is giving a meditative technique. When we say Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh of Hosts Hashem Tzvakot in the Kedusha, we should see the name like this, spelled out in its full form, like this, with the hey to remind us of the six. Then the waters are aligned. right? That causes the flow of energy or the lines to begin to flow down into our world. When we acknowledge God's transcendence, we're able to draw that transcendence into the world. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, hosts of hosts, to one place. This is right, Yesod, in the mystery of this name. The whole earth is full of his presence. And then once it's gathered there, like we said in the Shema, we're able to draw it down. And how do we draw it down? By rising up. We literally rise up when we recite this to try and reach transcendence. And in rising up from below, we're able to cause a channel to bring the energy down. So since we do that, says the Zohar, you have to be in their headspace to understand the next line, let the dry land appear. Because we're causing the energy to flow down by rising up, then land appears, dry land. Dry land is what is actually kind of hidden beneath the water. It's reality, but it's dry. It's like the Shekhinah. It receives, but it doesn't give. It's dry land. Engraved mystery, name of unity, Kuzu B'Muchzaz Kuzu. Okay, next time we're going to open up with, what does Kuzu B'Muchzaz Kuzu have to do with this? We're also going to do a little more fully, what is the Kabbalistic intention or understanding of the recitation of the Kedusha, which harkens back to earlier mystical schools, in particular this name of 45. So we're going to delve into a little bit. We're like heavy in theurgy now. How to recite the Shema according to this part of the Zohar, how to recite the Kedusha, according to this part of the Zohar, what does it do? And then Kuzu B'Muchzaz Kuzu is a mezuzah practice. So how should you do our mezuzot? So we're really like, we're hitting this is like greatest hits of the Zohar right now. We're in a little.
Yeah, it's a heck of a cliffhanger. Kol kavod.
Yeah, so next.
Technical thing, because I got way late. I received several emails from you about today that had a link on it. But the link wasn't our regular link.
Yes. Same here. I was
tripping. So I went to that other link and I was waiting there a little bit and then I
decided. No. Okay. Yeah. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, second years. I went to the website to finally get in, but
Okay, use this link. I don't know how to use Zoom. small technical problem. I'm glad you all found your way here. I hope we didn't lose anyone.
So ignore that other link that you sent and it came multiple times.
Let me share. Let me see. I'm trying to see if anyone missed this.
You sent like a Cal invitation, which is helpful, but the link apparently, but it was, 'cause I had the same issue. I thought it was just me. So thanks for.
Yeah.
Weird. Okay.
So get rid of that other link, and it's still our regular link. Okay.
I don't know. I don't know anything anymore. Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you. Glad
I clarified that.
Before we go, any final comments or questions?
I mean, it would take like a half hour.
Right. We'll wait for next time.
Next week.
Thrilling conclusion. Okay.